Welcome to the Medical Insider Podcast, where we highlight real-life solutions to your health challenges, incorporate new technology and proven solutions from the past with a healthy dose of common sense, while resisting the pitfalls of idiopathic classifications and economically based medical doctrine. This is your host, Dr. Thomas Santucci. Let's get started. Good morning, this is Dr. Santucci. I want to talk today about neurofeedback, and it's something we've talked about before. As a matter of fact, it's something we've done before. 10 years ago, we did neurofeedback. I'm going to show you some of those cases and some of the new cases we're doing. Neurofeedback really is an important tool that has been forgotten. So when I looked into how do you create the ideal clinic, I said, we need to bring this back. We evaluated about 15 different systems and looked at everything. And we ended up going with a system that was the next generation of what we used to do. So using brain scans and neurofeedback going together. What you're going to see in this is that neurofeedback has reinvented itself. And really, it's three things. It's a diagnostic tool. So it's an early indicator of physical things and neurochemical things that can go wrong. It obviously gives us a deeper understanding of psychological issues, including like everything from brain brightening to something on the spectrum. The other thing that neurofeedback is going to do is to help ensure a long, productive life. And this is something that I want to get really clear about. All of us should be doing something for our age management. And this is truly in the not included in your healthcare plan stuff that you should be taking a look at, just like health insurance, life insurance, longevity insurance is something that all of us need to pay attention to, especially as we get older. So digging into this, we basically put together a new PowerPoint because there's just so much new stuff. So I'm going to do a combination of sort of going through each of the things that we prepared and then giving you some editorial content. So neurofeedback, first of all, from an objective point of view, it's instrumental in learning difficulties, strokes, neurodegenerative decline, but also in brain brightening and things that really make a difference in your life. So when we talk about neurofeedback, so there's a brain scan initially, and then the neurofeedback part of it is actually an entrainment exercise, just like any other exercise that would myelinate a nerve. Strengthens these neural pathways, increases mental endurance and flexibility. And as you know, in things like heart rate variability, the ability of the body, the general adaptive syndrome, the general capability to react to real life is a huge thing in survival and happiness. So when we look at neurofeedback details, what we're really talking about is the ability to read impulses from deep cells in your brain that actually manage to, you know, summate and get past the skull, the meninges of the skull, and they're read by a very, very fine diode that then goes to very powerful computers for interpretation. So it's sort of like humans. Our sensory mechanisms aren't that great, especially compared to everybody else's and compared to what's really true in the world. But our ability to analyze is really profound. So neurofeedback takes these tiny little signals and turns them into very profound understandings of neuropsychological, physical, and biochemical states. So specifically, it's reading delta, theta, alpha, beta waves, and I'm going to go into each one of those things. So this is science. This is not something that is, you know, open to a lot of interpretation in terms of what's going on with the brain. So this is a movie of how a neurofeedback session actually looks. On the left is these indicators. We have a left hemisphere and a right hemisphere. And basically, when we're looking at a brain scan and neurofeedback, and you know, neurofeedback has constant scanning that goes into it, and it's billions of pieces of information that then turn into the familiar EEG, electroencephalograph. Electroencephalograph output is then converted to delta, theta, alpha, beta wave output, and then to things that have names like, you know, memory and focus and chemical issues. So this is what we're looking at during a session. What a patient is looking at is a movie. So a patient's basically looking at something that they're familiar with, And the system works in an operant training, so a reward basis. So when you're kind of looking at what you're doing in terms of training, you're looking at a movie that you're familiar with, and then the movie basically gets louder and less loud depending on what's going on. Brainwaves have been studied for a long time. This is about a 100-year-old industry. And what's happened is the same thing that happened with everything that's automated, that the ability to understand at a deep computational level has been, you know, exponentially exploded here. So we're dealing with literally billions of pieces of information. So the pyramidal cells in your brain send up a signal. It's read by the diodes on top of your skull. And we then create an EEG report. That EEG report is converted to something that's very, very common in the vernacular. So the delta, theta, alpha, and beta waves, and then gamma, if you want to go there. So delta waves are big loopy waves that represent sleep. So the deep access to the unconscious is what some people do. Theta waves, I think, has to do more with emotions because it's more amygdalar. It's more toward the center part of the brain. Alpha waves is kind of like regular social interaction. Beta waves is what hopefully all of us are engaging in occasionally, where we're thinking deeper. And then high beta is even more intense than that. Gamma wave is seen as multiprocessing. Some people think that gamma wave is the entrance to things like clairvoyance. But when we're looking at these waves and measuring them, at this point, there's a lot of information. These are distributed databases where all the information is compared. So we can look at ratios between the slow waves and the fast waves and make determinations about things like ADD. We can look at theta waves or alpha wave entrainment and make statements about sleep. When we're looking at beta waves, obviously that's the ability to do higher order thinking and concentration. If delta waves are going on at the same time, then they're going to interfere. So we can now take a normal person and basically kind of get a reset of what's going on with their actual thought processes and turn it into something actionable that we can train to be way, way, way more efficient. So looking at this technology, which is what this is computer-driven health, and the move to technology and medicine in general has objectified medicine. So there's way less of the, did you miss the diagnosis? Do you care about the diagnosis? Are you any good at fixing the diagnosis? To, I want consistent results that's science-based with good updates, less reliance on personal opinions, medications, and really conventional medicine. There's no two people that are the same in a brain scan, not even close. So when we're decoding the activity, we're looking at, you know, there is an interpretation part of this where the analyst looks and says, is this brain going too fast? Is this brain going too slow? What are the basic indicators in the delta, theta, alpha, beta waves that tell us, you know, what's the performance of the biochemical system? And one of the things that I really want to emphasize here, there's been so much, you know, kind of like internet chatter on the gut biome and, you know, the gut being the second brain and your what you eat determining your hormone levels, which will create impulsivity. Compared to what the brain is doing, all that stuff doesn't add up to anything. So the performance of neuroendocrine, neuromuscular, neurosexual systems are expressed by the brain. And so the brain is not only the central processor, it's really the determiner of your reality, much, much, much more than everything else combined. So almost everything comes in as a sensation to the back part of the brain. So either to the occipital lobe or the parietal temporal lobe, it's then shifted to the frontal lobe, and lots of imaginations go on in between all this. And the frontal lobe makes the determination. The very front part of the frontal lobe, the dorsolateral prefrontal cortex, is actually responsible for a level of kind of awareness and sophisticated treatment of input that really makes us human. So when people are using, something like, blood sugar or, enterocyte function, and saying what a human is, it's really very, very, very small input compared to what the frontal lobe is doing. So this chart is really talking about all the things that the brain does. And so someone once said in the advanced neuro world that anticipation is the highest use of the human brain. And so anticipation, again, is in that front part of your brain. So the brain monitors what's going on. It makes determinations first about safety. Lots of brain function is about safety. And then it says, what do you do about it? And then it makes the decisions on how much are you going to pay attention to something. How much we pay attention is an important thing in our society. If a person doesn't pay attention to what's going on, we view them as distractible. If they pay too much attention to what's going on and they don't get off the subject, we view that as perseverant. When we're looking at an appropriate level of attachment to the stimulation of life, and that's something that this can give us insight in. And you might imagine when you're measuring this many things, and I'm talking about on normal people, and I think I'm talking about you. So when we're talking about that, everybody has some things that can be tuned up. So it's not a condemnation. It's more like you take your car to a good car place, they find the five things that are wrong, and then they fix them. So the other thing it does for quote unquote normal people is that it looks at what's happened to you, your brain, your genetic components, your stress, any diseases, anything that can shift the brain out of regulation. And then it can create a map that actually can bring you back. So the tuning up of a quote unquote normal brain is a major positive impact of this kind of technology. So executive function, decisiveness, memory, sleep, anxiety, toxicity. The reality for most of us, we're living with some kind of neural compromise, sort of like low air pressure in a car. Again, neurofeedback can identify and rectify this. This is usually a click, and this it's having to roll in, so I'm going past the thing. These are some of the benefits of neurofeedback, and that for a normal person, I would say increased mental clarity is the big thing. If there's a sleep problem, it does that. Mood is much, much more subtle. Almost everybody, you know, in our kind of age bracket can admit to some kind of memory loss, especially short-term memory loss. But it's interesting that nobody thinks that they have a judgment problem. And judgment is done by these same systems. So one of the things that this does is it gives you a feeling of capability and control because you're actually processing things a lot more accurately. When we're looking at conditions, you know, I put a few of these up here: memory, mood, control, aging, developmental delays, neurocognitive capability. But these are now math equations. So when we're looking at the relationship of this side of the temporal lobe going to the frontal lobe, that's where we're talking about executive functions being really manifested. So when we measure those pathways, these vectors, if you will, we can get a definitive kind of a read on five different kinds of memory. On the other side, we're going to look at emotional responses, empathy, security, control. Toward the back of the brain, we're going to be looking much more about body awareness, sort of what the parietal lobe does. On the other side, we're going to look at things that can cause headaches, vertigo, panic attacks, that kind of a thing. So this is really a little roadmap for how your body is operating. It's not just neuropsych stuff. So what's the research say on all this? This is one of the things that's kind of fun for me because we do a lot of protocols that are way beyond the research. So the research just hasn't caught up to what the clinical reality is. In functional medicine, it was always the other way. The functional medicine is really just find out what they found out in the research 10 years ago and try to copy some of it. In regenerative medicine, and certainly in genomic medicine and DNA level chemical testing, the practitioners are way ahead of the researchers, or at least anything that's accepted by conventional medicine. So this is that world. So neurofeedback objectively improves memory and what we call peak alpha frequencies in people with mild cognitive impairment. So these are people that have been measured to have a memory deficit and it has reversed it. The interesting thing about that is that nobody cared. So we're actually fixing the beginning part of neurodementias, which is going to be one of the biggest epidemics in this country. And it just got a big yawn from a opportunity point of view and really, you know, an avenue to help us live a long, productive life. This is not something that should be ignored. So looking at this, you know, we've got neurofeedback as kind of a cornerstone. We've got genetic testing or genomic testing, you know, where we're looking at the subnuclear polymorphisms. And then we've got regenerative treatments. So whatever the closest thing to stem cells you can get your hands on. So mesenchymal stem cells, exosomes, Wharton's jelly, those things. But I would say any responsible plan for really age management would include those three things. And you'd probably start with this one. And again, this is safe. It works really well. It's applicable to almost every situation. So when we look at memory is one of those things that I think if you kind of look at the interrelationship of brain, there used to be a theory that the brain was holographic. And holographic means that if it was like made out of glass, each one of you broke it, the shards of glass would each represent the entire whole. That is not how memory works at all. Obviously, memory is stored in the deep recesses of the hippocampus, which is in an area of the brain that is almost lizard-like. So we've got the brain stem, then we've got this, you know, this basic bulging out in the middle of the brain that is the amygdala, that is the emotional centers of the brain. So memory and emotion are very closely tied. You know, things that develop together fire together. And so when we're looking at memory, we've got a memory core, but it's fed from all these different places. So sight can spur a memory. Obviously, olfaction can stir a memory. If you think about, you know, a smell, you go into a bakery and all of a sudden you're 8 years old and it brings those back. So it's really like a traffic hub. So these vertices all come in from these different feeder systems and they basically feed the central processing of memory. When we lose memory, we like to think of it as hippocampal. So when we look at neurocognitive loss, when we look at Alzheimer's, when we look at some aspects of dementias, we're always looking at the amygdala, I'm sorry, the hippocampus, you know, which is that memory center, but really it's everywhere in the brain. So this is a map that kind of shows us that lots and lots of brain functions are fed in from the periphery. So obviously, you know, a good part of the people that come in for interventional care with neurofeedback have anxiety and depression. And, you know, coming from a neuropsychiatric background, coming from a family where my father was a psychiatrist, a surgeon and a psychiatrist, you know, I saw a lot of this growing up, and there was so much, extra activity around the diagnosis. There was so much, you know, is this an indication of weakness? Is this an indication of, you know, a basic way a person is? And our understanding of anxiety and depression has really evolved. And, you know, now I can look at most anxious people and go, yeah, that's an inappropriate firing of this kind of wave because of that situation. And without, you know, it's not hard to be really seriously empathetic to it because you look at it and you go, if any person was in that person's situation, that's how they would behave. Anxiety is a higher energy state, and eventually anxiety turns into depression, mostly because the sympathetic component of it is just too hard to maintain. I think one of the most exciting things about neurofeedback is its capability to come in and really contribute to the age management side. As your brain ages, you age. And one of the things that we've seen is that there are professions whose brains don't age as fast. Teachers, lawyers, doctors. How come this group of people seems to do better than other groups of people? And it's not genetic. It turns out that you can myelinate pathways depending on what your physical neural activity is. So starting with physical, you know, we all know we can build new brain cells, but with physical activity, brain-derived neurotrophic factor will do it. You don't have to take any drugs. You just have to exercise. But cognitive enhancement, the ability to improve how you are processing. So definitely memory, definitely, you know, social interaction, definitely all that kind of stuff. but they can be myelinated pathways. It upsets me sometimes when I look at correlation analysis and it says, you know, people that tango danced have longer lives. And I was like, right, it's basically an aerobic exercise that's social, and it correlates with like 20 things that are consecutive or coincidental with longer life. So when we're looking at this, we're not talking about that kind of analysis. What we're talking about is, how can you take memory, attention, executive function and remyelinate those pathways? And I mean in anybody. Stress reduction is almost automatic here. By balancing out the hemispheric firing of the brain, by balancing out each side of the brain, and by balancing out the different kind of waves, especially beta waves, you're going to reduce anxiety. Additionally, brain scans are going to identify environmental factors that may be overwhelming the brain. We just did one the other day and the entire brain was on fire. And it was just very, very obvious that we had a systemic inflammation that included the brain. So we come in with the antibody interjections where you're taking the person off of, you know, gluten, dairy, egg, yeast, soy, all the things that can cause a problem there, fixing metals if that exists, and fixing sex hormones. And all of a sudden you have an environment that's untrainable. In any case, we would still do a brain scan neurofeedback to try to get balance in those systems. If we can get the activities of daily life stuff in there and then come in with something with more profound testing like the SNP testing, then we would probably be able to move that even in a very, very, very difficult patient. When we're talking about neuroplasticity, brains are neuroplastic. There's more connections in brains than there are, you know, planets and galaxies in the universe, in the entire of reality. So brains reset themselves all the time. Your ability, you know, this general adaptive syndrome capability, your ability to generate new synapses is a huge part, not just of, you know, how happy you are, how successful you are, but also how long you live. So brain health maintenance is just something that everybody should add to their priority list. And, you know, there's two problems with that statement. One is nobody does it. The other is almost everything neural sounds like a joke. You know, growing up in that kind of an environment, you know, the least sincere funny thing we could say in our family was, how does that make you feel? So our society does not do a good job with this. So this is something that, you know, in order to adopt, you probably have to go away from the pack. This is not, you know, what your hairdresser understands. It's certainly not what your friends understand. And it's probably not what your medical community understands. But if you add this to your priority list, you probably are doing the biggest favor to yourself and, you know, your healthy long life of almost anything you can do. So when we're looking at normal aging, you know, and it's, I love the word normal because I'm going to distinguish it from common, because common brain aging is massive inequality between the brains. It's microbleeds. It's all kinds of poisonings. It's infarctions. An interesting coronary statistic is that 50% of people have as their first symptom of coronary artery disease is death. So they don't get pain in their chest. They don't have shortness of breath. They don't have obvious memory or physical performance problems. They just die. So that's what normal people are doing. So when we're talking about normal brain aging, you know, on the other side, this is what they're doing. So symmetrical ventricular enlargement, and then basically changing in the size of the brain is normal. Now, it's not optimal and it's not necessary, but it is what normal people are doing. So obviously, when we're looking at the neurodegenerative conditions, you know, Alzheimer's is going to be the next big epidemic. There's probably about a 6 times increase of Alzheimer's that's going to occur. And Alzheimer's, as you remember, basically affects the hippocampus, but it has as a presentation an exudate, so, you know, a destruction of the tau proteins of the nerve, and something that looks a lot like cholesterol in the brain, although it's not. And so when we're looking at that, we can diagnose it. But in almost all cases, there hasn't been a really effective way to deal with Alzheimer's. And there really isn't going to be a proactive program for this. If I had to right now say what I would do with Alzheimer's is that I would get a brain scan, I would do neurofeedback, I'd correct whatever I would find, I would certainly concentrate on the memory centers. I'd do the subnuclear polymorphism testing and see what the brain inflammatory markers like IL-6 are. I would make sure that every endocrine system was perfect. I would also probably go, off the mainland and get stem cells. I would probably do intranasal stem cells, which is going to address many, many, many of the issues of Alzheimer's deposition. So, and that is, I think, the most enlightened kind of cocktail of things that a person could do for Alzheimer's. It's interesting. I presented that material about 4 years ago to the functional medicine group, which was about 500 very, very, very smart doctors. And as yet, no one's adopted it. So it's interesting to me that, we sit there and say that things are idiopathic, and we sit there and say that there's no way that you can get on the other side of it. And when presented with a viable plan, the regular world doesn't pick up on it. So this is a theme. So in most things that we're talking about that go beyond the group, you're not going to be with the group. Thanks for listening to the Medical Insider Podcast. If you enjoyed today's episode, make sure you visit medicalinsider.com. Go ahead and sign up for these episodes. Get them sent directly to your inbox. Do us a favor and give us a like.